Herman Boone. I'm the new assistant coach.
Well, for the looks of things, I'd say we got about all the help we need around here. Why ain't you outside there with all your little friends hollering?
This was the time that was arranged for me to meet with Coach Yost. I never miss an appointment.
Well, maybe you just better reschedule.
Coach Boone's school board made the decision to put you on my staff. I did not hire you.
Well, I came up here to coach at GW. I didn't ask the schools to redistrict. I didn't ask to be assigned to your staff, so I guess we're both in a situation we don't want to be in. But I can guarantee you this, Coach. I come to win.
Win? Coach Yost here has been nominated to the Virginia High School Hall of Fame. 15 winning seasons.
Well, I won a couple of titles down in North Carolina.
That's double-A ball. This here's Virginia. We play triple-A.
Well, what an opportunity for me then. To learn from the best.
Pretty heavy, huh? No? Oh, okay. Let me change my intro to the comedic intro, right? That's heavy. I mean, regardless of where you grew up or what your background is, that's a heavy scene. We're looking at a movie today, one of my favorite movies called Remember the Titans. Who's seen Remember the Titans? Most people. This movie's set in 1971, and in 1971, it was a really volatile time for race relations in our country. And you need to keep in mind that it had only been 3 years since Martin Luther King Jr. was gunned down outside the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. And when I imagined 50 years ago that a black man could not go into many of the same restaurants that a white man could and eat the same meals, that blows my mind. Or when I think that 50 years ago a black woman could not sit in the same seats on the bus as many white women could, that's hard for my brain to see because I wasn't there. And some of us today that are here, some of you were actually alive in those days. And you're old enough to remember the tension that you guys faced and the tension that our country went through over this whole issue. But you'd think after everything that happened with the civil rights movements in the 1960s, that by the time 1971 came around, our country, well, things would have eased up, that it wouldn't have been that tense. But it wasn't like that at all. In many places in the South. And Alexandria, Virginia, where this movie was set, was definitely not an integrated city. But then the school board decided to take two schools, one an entirely white school and one an entirely black school, and bus kids into a new location and have one brand new school, and create one integrated school out of the two. And this new school would have the white coach and the black coach working on the same staff for the first time. And so, for the first time, white kids and black kids found themselves being bused for the very first time together, sitting next to one another for the very first time, and playing on a sports team together for the very first time. And in the clip we saw, that did a great job of introducing us to the tension that our country found itself in at that time. And keep in mind, this wasn't a result of these two teams willingly coming together and saying, "Ah, let's do a fun social experiment and just have a lot of fun here." It didn't really seem like a lot of fun, right? Didn't seem like they were having a great time in that clip. No, this was forced on them. It was a forced integration by the school board. And so both men found themselves in a pretty unique situation, didn't they? Forced to be with the other. I chose this movie because it's one of my favorite movies. And I rewatched it a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. And man, every time I watch this, it's so rich. It's so deep. There's so much content. It's so passionate. It's so revealing, and I'm just filled with a lot of questions. And so today I want to talk about some questions. I want to share some of those with you that I've asked myself. But before we do that, I realize that this movie came out a good bit ago. And so what I want to do is take us all through a handful of clips that are going to give us sort of a picture of what was going on through this movie. So if you haven't seen it in a long time, I'm going to bring you up to speed. And if you've never seen it, I'm going to bring you up to speed. So the school board makes yet another controversial decision. Not only did they bring Herman Boone onto Coach Yost's staff, they decided, you know what, we've got to make a statement to our city that we're really behind this whole idea of integration. So we're actually going to promote Herman Boone to be the head coach. And now Coach Yost, who's been destined for the Virginia Hall of Fame for high school, he's now finding himself working for Coach Boone. And so this next clip shows the tension of what happens when white players and black players at that time in our history come together for the first time. And as we're watching, I want you to watch for a really interesting character who shows up in the middle of this scene. He sticks out like a sore thumb. You can't really miss him. And I think you'll notice that he doesn't seem to really care who's white and who's black. Let's take a look.
Check on me. I'm Coach Hines, your offensive line coach. Get out your name and position starting from the right.
Petey Jones, running back. The running back, y'all.
Jared Harris, quarterback.
Rev.
It's a nickname.
And who in the name of heaven might you be?
I'm Louis Lastic, offensive lineman. Naval family, just moved here from Bayonne. Someone said football, so I come running. What's going on, everybody?
With him calling the shots, ain't none of us gonna see nothing but the bench this year.
You ain't calling the shots, you'll play.
You feel the tension? It's palpable, huh? So that's what happens when these two groups come together for the very first time. And now Coach Boone, who's the new head coach, announces to the team that they're all going to go together to Gettysburg College for a week, and they're going to learn new plays, and they're going to try to come together as a team. And the day that they showed up to go to camp, Coach Boone noticed something really interesting. There were two big school buses ready to go. And he noticed something, and that was that these kids self-segregated. And what I mean by that is all the black players put themselves on one bus, and all of the white players put themselves on another bus. And so Boone took matters into his own hands in this effort to force these boys to come together. Take a look.
Listen up. I want everybody off the bus. Let's go. Follow me. Everybody. Let's go right now. All right. Everybody off the bus. Listen up. I don't care if you're black, green, blue, white, or orange. I want all of my defensive players on this side. All players going out for offense over here. Right now. Let's move. Let's move. Let's move. Let's move. You and you. Offensive bus, sit together. You and you. Defensive bus, sit together. Get comfortable, too. Because the person that I have you sitting next to is the same one that you'll be rooming with for the duration of this camp.
Those of us who had coaches that yelled at us in high school are having a little PTSD right now. That's a pretty powerful clip there, wasn't it? Why do you suppose that Boone did that? Why did he make everybody get off the bus and then get on the bus in a different way? Do you think he just was trying to ruffle everyone's feathers or trying to tick everybody off? Maybe he's going to make everybody mad so they can carry that passion into camp? Do you think that's why he did it? I think maybe it's because he knew that the closer you get to someone, the more human they become. Isn't that true? The closer you get to someone, the harder it is to categorize them or just allow them to be a statistic. You really, when you get closer to someone, you begin to see through all of that. And the truth is, the more human that I see that you are by being closer to you, the more I start recognizing that we're actually a lot alike. And Coach Boone needed those guys to come together. He needed them to be equal, on the same page, to see each other as one another, as teammates. So once they got to the camp, he did something really unorthodox. He said, I want you to meet with a player of the opposite color as you, and I want you to get to know everything about this person. I want you to know everything that's going on with them, what their hopes and what their dreams are. I want you to know about their family, and then I want you to report back to me. And until every person here knows every other person, we're going to make a switch and go to 3-a-day football practices. So imagine doing 3 practices a day until you get to know every single person in the hot Virginia sun. It was not a lot of fun. And listen, these guys had been deeply ingrained since they were born that white and black did not mix. And so Boone was asking them to do something that went against the core of everything that they'd ever been told in their entire life. And these guys just wanted to get it over with. And so they did the very bare minimum to get to know one another. And it comes to head in this next scene. Take a look.
All right, man, listen. I'm Gary. You're Julius. Let's get some particulars and just get this over with, all right?
Particulars?
Yeah.
No matter what I tell you, you ain't gonna never know nothing about
me.
Hey,
listen. I ain't running any more of these 3 days, okay?
Well, what I got to say, you really don't want to hear, because honesty ain't too high up on your people priority list, right?
Honesty? You want honesty? All right, honestly, I think you're nothing. Nothing but a pure waste of God-given talent. You don't listen to nobody, man. Not even Doc or Boone. Shiver push on the line every time, man. You blow right past them. Push them. Pull them. Do something. You can't run over everybody in this league. And every time you do, you leave one of your teammates hanging out to dry. Me in particular.
Why should I give a hoot about you? Huh? Or anybody else out there? You want to talk about a waste? You the captain, right?
Right.
Captain's supposed to be the leader, right?
Right.
You got a job?
I have a
job. You been doing your job?
I've been doing my job.
Then why don't you tell your white buddies to block for Rev better? Because they have not blocked for him worth a plug nickel, and you know it. Nobody plays, yourself included. I'm supposed to wear myself out for the team? What team? No. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look out for myself, and I'm going to get mine.
See, man, that's the worst attitude I ever heard.
Attitude reflect leadership, Captain.
If you listen closely and you're a teenager, I just gave you an amazing line to use on your parents. Okay. Attitude reflects leadership. Try it on your parents. Post on my Facebook wall what happened. I'd love to know. Little research project. I think we could all remember a time in our life where someone comes to us and calls us on the carpet for something that we're not supposed to be doing, right? Or that we should be doing that we're not. It's uncomfortable. It's painful. And I imagine that in this point in the movie, Gary starts feeling that pain. It's where he's reminded that he's the team captain. And I think that he begins to realize here that if this team is going to go where they need to go, that white and black will mix. But so much more importantly than that, they will start seeing one another as people. He realizes he's going to have to lead the way. And I think Boone understands that the stakes are very, very high here. And so at 4 o'clock in the morning, he gets all of these guys up and takes them on a run through the woods to a very special place. Take a look at this.
Anybody know what this place is? This is Gettysburg. This is where they fought the Battle of Gettysburg. 50,000 men died right here on this field, fighting the same fight that we're still fighting amongst ourselves today. This green field right here, painted red, bubbling with the blood of young boys, smoke, and hot lead going right through their bodies. Listen to their souls, man. I killed my brother with malice in my heart. Hatred destroyed my family. You listen. You take a lesson from the dead. If we don't come together right now on this hollow ground, we too will be destroyed. Just like they were. I don't care if you like each other or not, but you will respect each other. And maybe, I don't know, maybe you will learn to play this game like men.
I love this movie because the writing is just fantastic, isn't it? Denzel Washington, I will admit I have a man crush on him. I know you ladies were thinking this whole time, like, that's 1996 sexiest man alive right there. Yeah. He's hot, I can admit it. He's a great actor, and he delivers that with such power. Did you feel it, like what he was saying? Like this, in this place where so many of our forefathers, they destroyed themselves. And if we don't somehow interject something different here, we're destined to repeat their fate. And we don't want to do that. And so I want to show you one other clip, and then I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things we can draw from in this movie. And so far we've seen the tension that these boys, not only these boys, but the whole town have to face. We see Julius challenge Gary to stand up and lead. And we've seen Coach Boone sharing from his heart what's at stake. But this next scene really is where things begin to shift. This next scene is really the pivot point of the whole movie. Take a look.
All right. We'll be out here all night till we get this thing right. Let's go. On the ball, Rev.
Get it right. Hey! Hey! Woo! Let's go.
What was that, Ray? Whatever it is, it ain't blocking.
Give me a break.
You want a break? I'll give you a break. Me and Julius.
Let them in.
Get to Rev once, just one time. I swear to God, I'm going to hit you so hard by the time you come to. Ooh, boy, you're going to need a new haircut. You understand me? Let's play, fellas.
On the ball. Let's run it again.
Let's go. Run it up. Run it up. Run it up.
Hey!
Let's go.
All right.
My side.
Hey!
Me.
You all right, Big Petey?
You all right?
You really stuck him, Campbell.
Yeah, I love me a little contact, Petey.
This is left side.
Strong side.
Left side.
Strong side.
Left side.
Strong side.
Left side.
And that really was the turning point of the movie, because that's where the team really starts coming together. Julius and Gary really decide, hey, we're on the same team. We're working for the same cause here. And so after that turning point, they started really looking like a team, and then they went back home. And yes, there were some bumps along the way and some real tension, as these guys had this sort of camaraderie when they went back home, and not everybody in the city felt that. But something amazing happened, and that is that they started winning. And they started winning a game after game, and everybody was really excited. But it was so much more than that. See, their courage to work through their issues and to overcome their stereotypes and to work through years and years of prejudice and judgment, their willingness to push through that together ended up turning that entire town upside down. But what I want to do in our remaining time this morning is to take a step back from this film. Because I think it would be super easy for you and I to look at this movie and go, oh, that was a neat football movie, right? Or that was a movie about racial tension in the South in the United States in 1971. Or that was about prejudice in one way or another. And while that might be true at its very basic level, I had to walk away from this movie and ask myself, why is this movie really speaking to me the way that it is? There are all these other movies I could have talked about. Why was this movie like shouting at me saying, talk about this one? And after I thought about it for a bit, I really came to this realization that this movie's not just about a football team coming together in 1971. This movie really is about me. And you know what? This movie's really about you. And this movie's really about all of us. Because what we see happening in this movie is something that has happened for every generation that has existed since the dawn of humanity. And it happens in our homes even. It happens in our workplaces. It happens in our cities, and I hate saying this, but sometimes it even happens in our churches. And on the surface, we might think like, oh, that's racism, or it's stereotyping, or it's prejudice, or it's judging or labeling, and often it really does include those things. But what I want to talk about today is the thing that I think is behind all of that, that's truly at the core. It's what ultimately plays out when we forget a very, very important truth from time to time. When we forget what might be one of the most important truths to be revealed in all of the scriptures. And it's this very simple idea. Listen, we are all made in the image of God. That's the truth that we've forgotten. And anything that causes us to put ourselves at a higher level than our brother or our sister, or think that we're positioned better than someone else, whether it's our neighbor or whether it's a coworker or whether it's some minority or whether it's a majority or whether it's someone on another continent, anytime we do that, I think it's ultimately due to the fact that we've forgotten something very important that was revealed to us way back at the very beginning of the Bible. And in the opening chapters of Genesis, we see this amazing creation story where God is speaking everything into existence, and he creates the heavens and the earth, and he sets the stars in the sky, and he creates plants and animals, and he does all of these sorts of things, but yet he was still not done. He went on to create the hallmark of all his creation. And we read these amazing verses in the first chapter of Genesis, and it says this: "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." And then it goes on to say, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very..." That's your cue. I'm doing my part. You got to do your part. I did my part. And for every time you don't respond, I'm adding 10 minutes to this message. Do you understand? And it's a nice day outside. So when I point to you, you say it, okay? Here we go. Let's try it again. "And behold, it was very..." You guys want to get out of here. Awesome. "There was evening and there was morning, the sixth day." And I think from this passage, we can glean two really important truths. One, that God created everyone in his image. And two, what? That it was good. Now turn to the person to your right, and I want you to say to them, "You are very good." That was a lot of unsure people. You must have been sitting next to your kids or your spouse, all right? So I'm going to give you a chance to redeem yourself. I want you to look to the person on your left now, and I want you to say, "You are very good." Hey, you guys, more believable that time. Do you realize that when we read these words of Scripture, we're not just reading some old book that was thrown together that meant something significant then, but now it's just some story. Listen, this is the God of the universe. God showed the primacy of creation in the order that he created it. He created all of these things, and then he created mankind, his very most pleasing creation. And God said that after that, it was very good. And when we read these verses, that's God saying it to us, that I created you. Listen, I created you in my image, and it is very good. And he's not only saying that to you and me, he's saying that to our neighbor and to our friends and even to our enemy. You know, those people who are like us and to those people who are a lot different from us. And so I think what we see in this movie is the same thing that we see in our lives over and over and over. And that is what happens when people forget that everyone is made in God's image and are loved by him. And when we forget that, injustice happens. Oppression happens. We have a lack of belief in ourselves. Or we start having apathy toward other people. All those things happen in our lives. And when we forget this truth, it's at that moment that we look at people who are different from us and we label them as other, don't we? Those who are different or unwanted or to be avoided or somehow are lesser than us. And the bottom line is this: drawing a distinction between us and others in our lives. Listen, drawing that line, that's going to be you. And it's going to be the default for me too, unless we're intentional to seek to connect to people who are different than us and affirming that God created them in his image and acknowledging that he said it was good. So in light of that, what I want to do is take a step back, and I just want to share with you three simple questions that I'm asking myself after watching this movie. And I want to encourage you to grab a pen and to grab the service guide you got when you came in the door and write these down, because I think these are so important. Listen, after two services and going into the third, I'm completely convinced that this message is relevant for our community, and it's important for every single person here. We need to chew on these questions. And here's the first question. Number one, who are the others in my life? Who are the others in my life? The bottom line is we all have others, don't we? I'm not talking about those people on the island across the island from the main people on Lost, okay? Those were others. I'm talking about a different kind of others. I'm saying that we all have people that we try to avoid for one reason or another, don't we? We have people that we've led ourselves to believe an untruth about them, or we think we have nothing in common with them. And maybe it's someone with a different color of skin, or maybe someone who was born in a different country, or who makes more or less money than you and I do. We all have others. And I know that's true because we all have neighbors, right? And right now when I say that, you can think to yourself, oh, my crazy neighbor that's crazy, that neighbor's crazy. I'm scanning the crowd to see if any of my neighbors are here. Have you ever thought about the fact that your neighbors might look at you as the crazy one in your neighborhood, right? Believe it or not, some of us, our neighbors, to them, we are their other, right? So I know that we've all experienced that because we all have neighbors. Also, some of us have in-laws. I'm not going to tackle that right now. I'm not going to go there. We're going to move on. But the truth is, usually, you know, I don't think that we're bad people. I don't think that it's usually an outright racism or prejudice, or I don't think that we want to just stick it to other humans. So sometimes we just forget about other people. And maybe we forget about those people who are out of sight, out of mind. And so we watch the news and we see all of these things like immigration. Hot topic in our country right now, isn't it? Right? Well, maybe I don't personally know anyone who's struggling through this issue because it really is messy. And since I don't know anyone, it's easy for me just to have apathy and to go, I'm not even going to think about that. Or all the issues we're hearing about in Egypt. There's a lot of civil unrest happening in Egypt. People died yesterday because of what's going on with the turnover in the government. Well, it's easy for me to go, I don't live there. I don't know any Egyptian people. I don't know anything about the culture. And so I'm not even going to think about it. So sometimes our other are those people that we just ignore because they're so far away. We don't know the plight of people around the world. And I think for me, I've talked about this and I've shared pretty openly about how I think for me, the other is really people who are much like me. I grew up in a home that there was a lot of pain. And so I feel like for years, God sent people in my path that had trauma in their life or had some emotional baggage that they needed to deal with. And I got to where I could see people like that who were hurting. I could see them a mile away. And when they started coming close to me, I would be like, you know, the pain detector would go off. And I'd go, get away from me. And I made those people who were very much like me my other. And now I look back and realize how silly that was, because the things that God has done in my life are things I could turn around and speak a kind word into their life and an encouraging word and say, look, your life matters. Your life has purpose. Your life has meaning. God wants to do something through you. Your pain doesn't just define you and mean that you have nothing to contribute to this world, but because I labeled them as the other, because when they came near me, they were like a mirror showing me my own pain, and I pushed them away, it robbed me of my ability to love them well. You know, maybe for you, it's the person like that. It's someone who's just like you. Or maybe it's someone that you don't understand. Someone who's really different from you. You know, maybe for some of us, it's our other is someone with a different color of skin. Or a person with a different sexual orientation. Or a person who's a different religion. Or a rich person. Or a poor person. Or maybe a Republican. Or maybe a Democrat. Maybe those are our others. And the bottom line is, we all have them. But the question is, will you get honest with yourself and ask yourself, who are the others in my life? There's this story in the Bible. It's one of my favorite passages. And it's a story really all about others. And it's found in John chapter 4. It's the story about Jesus, where he goes from Judea to Galilee. And he ends up going through this shortest path to get there, which is Samaria, and interacts with this woman along the way. And at first glance, when you read that, you might think, oh, what's the big deal? But listen, it was really a big deal. The fact that Jesus would even go through Samaria was a big deal, because to Jews of the first century, Samaria was nothing but filled with the other. In their mind, they looked at Samaritans like we would look if we had a pantry and we opened it up and it was filled with roaches. Gross, right? That's exactly the way that they saw Samaritans. So they would never, absolutely never, go through Samaria, because they would label them as unclean. They were less than human. And they'd do whatever it took to avoid them at all cost. And no Jewish rabbi would walk straight through Samaria to get to Galilee. They would have went around, even though it meant adding a lot of time to their trip. So the fact that Jesus sort of ignored all of that cultural taboo and went straight into Samaria, well, That was huge. It'd be like the jock in high school. You know how cliquish we were in high school? Remember that? Everybody had like their different tables at lunch. You had the popular kids, and you had the rich kids. You had the jocks. Then you had the nerdy kids, the geeky kids, right? It'd be like the coolest jock at the jock table going and sitting at the geekiest, nerdiest table. Weirdo table. It just doesn't happen. Or it might be like an Israeli man who crosses the border into Palestine and goes to knock on a house and asks to sit down and have dinner with a Palestinian family. Or it might be like a conservative evangelical from somewhere in Naperville or in our area going to a bar in Boys Town and hanging out with people and saying, let's hang out, let's talk. It was really radical. So even the Jews of the first century, they had their other. And people in 1971 in Alexandria, Virginia, they had their other. And really, we all have the other. And so the question I'm asking myself is, who are the others in my life? And I'd ask you, who are the others in your life? Let's look at the next question. And this is a question that I think can actually help us take a step toward really understanding the other. And it's this question. How can I shift my proximity? Would you say that with me? How can I shift my proximity? I think we're a lot like the guys in the movie where we have a tendency to self-segregate, don't we? Where we ended up surrounding ourselves with others who are the same as us, though, right? I mean, we hang out with people who look like us or believe what we believe or they live where we live and they make about what we make and so on and so forth. We're so homogenous. And this is especially true for those of us who live in the suburbs, right? I mean, remember, like, if you're one of the first people in your housing addition and you go in and you sit down with the builder and they lay out, like, the five or six plans for a house and you look at it and go, oh, that one is me. That one screams me, man. And so they create your house. You move into that house and you're proud and you have all this open space around you. And then what happens is, one after another, 800 other houses go in and you realize one in five houses are exactly the same as what you have. And then when you come home from work, you tell the same stories to the same people. It all feels the same. That's part of where we are. But what if we truly asked ourselves the question, how can I shift my proximity? It's easy to think when we think proximity of physical space, right? Like how close to someone I am right now. Like I'm, 8 feet away from the people on the front row, or my house is 20 feet from my neighbor's house. But I think there's also an aspect of proximity that has to do with engagement of the heart, our connection to other people, or how much or the way in which we understand other people. And there's so much more to it than just being there physically. Sometimes my wife says to me something that I'm sure no one else has ever heard, and that is, you're here, but you're not really here. Guys, am I the only one? You guys ever hear that too? I have this amazing ability to physically be present, but emotionally or mentally disconnect. I think that's something that we all as humans do, because sometimes we can be physically close to someone, but our heart is checked out. We're far away. Or sometimes we can be far away physically from someone and be close to them. I know that's true because Annette and I, when we were dating, we, for a year or so, had to date long distance. I do not recommend that. It stinks. I like being around her. But I can tell you, it doesn't matter how far away she was from me, she was always close to me in my heart. I get points for that? Yeah. Write that down. That's good. That's true, though. That's us as humans. We can be really close to people halfway around the world in our heart. We all know people like that, who they really care about people in Africa. We just had a team come back from El Salvador investing in the lives of orphans, and every single person that went on that trip, they might be distant right now physically, but in their heart, it's very real to them. They're investing through prayer, and then they actually go on trips. And so for some people, we need to make a physical shift. And for others, we got to shift the posture of our hearts. And I think Jesus models this shift in proximity beautifully in this John chapter 4. And in verse 4, we read where it says, and he had to pass through Samaria. And when it says he had to pass through, I don't think he's saying that, like, the only way there was to go through Samaria. No, it's saying he willingly chose, he felt compelled to do that. And remember how I said most Jews would go completely around Samaria to get where they were going, even though it might take them twice as long to get there. But that's the path they would take. And remember this, that even though they did that, the short road was always an option, wasn't it? There was no sign or no barrier or no banner that said you can't travel through here. It wasn't like that at all. It was always option for them to do that, but it was painful. And it meant acknowledging the other. And most people simply wouldn't do that. And I think the same is true today, that most people will not acknowledge the other. We'll run from it. We'll turn our back. We'll talk bad about it. We won't actually engage other people who are different than us. And I think we see that Jesus models this massive shift in proximity by going on into Samaria and sitting at this well here. He knew that he was going to run into people who were the other. Remember, his people, the Jewish people, felt like the Samaritans were like roaches. They were just everywhere. So he knew by going through Samaria and sitting down at this well, he was going to run into the other. Why do you think Jesus was so intentional about that? Why was he so intentional that he crossed cultural boundaries and sat down and had a conversation with a woman and looked her straight in the eye? I think it's because he knew he could be near the other, to show us that sometimes we have to take the shortest road, even though sometimes it's outside of our comfort zone. Sometimes we have to go places that we haven't been. Our proximity has to be shifted. He knew we had to do that to get near the other. But again, why? Was it so that God would be somehow impressed with us because we hang out with people who are different from us? Or so that our church will think that we're doing a good job, or that we would somehow think that we're doing some great moral duty by investing in other people? It's not so that we would look great to our neighbor or have some sort of superior morality. Listen, no. Jesus was intentional to model that proximity leads to understanding. I can't help but be near you. I can't help when I'm close to you to start understanding a little bit about what makes you you. And when we begin to understand people, we begin to be reminded that they're created in the image of God. And it's awfully hard to have enemies when you remember that your brother and your sister is created in the image of God. In this movie, Boone made the shift to make the boys sit together in a room together and get to know one another, and he made a shift in proximity because he knew that was the only way that these guys would start seeing one another as human. So for you and I, we need to ask ourselves, what shifts in proximity, either physically or in our heart, do we need to make so that we can understand others? For some of us, it might be a physical shift, like taking a trip, an exploring part of the world. Or it might be today when you drive home that you drive through a neighborhood that you normally wouldn't go through because you're afraid. Or it might be eating at a restaurant that serves up a different culture's ethnic food than something you eat all the time. For others of us, it might be educating ourselves and getting to know about people who are different from us. So maybe it's reading a book, or maybe it's going on Netflix and watching a documentary. And before I share the third clip, I want to dive into one final clip that I think illustrates beautifully this whole idea that we're talking about. And this clip takes place after the team's been very successful. And then in the midst of celebration, tragically, Gary Bertier was hit by a truck and paralyzed from the waist down. And so in this scene, we find ourselves with Gary in the hospital and Julius going to see him. And in the midst of a very sad circumstance, we see a very poetic moment that I think shows the beauty that can happen when we ask ourselves, who's the other in my life? And how can I shift my proximity and begin to understand them? Take a look.
Only Ken's allowed in here.
Alice, are you blind? Don't you see the family resemblance? That's my brother.
Oh, man. You think I look banged up? You should see my Camaro.
Man. I sure am sorry, man. I should have been there with you.
What are you talking about? You would have been in the bed right next to me.
You can't be hurt like this. You're Superman.
I was afraid of you, Julius. I only saw what I was afraid of. And now I know I was only hating my brother.
I tell you what, though. When all this is over, and you're gonna move out the same neighborhood together, okay, and, you'll get old, you're gonna get fat. It ain't gonna be all this black white between us.
Left side.
Strong side.
Beautiful. So the first question we talked about today was, who are the others in my life? And the second question was, how can I shift my proximity? And those are really great questions, but I want to end with one final question that I think really speaks to why those other questions are important. And it's a question that has to do with this word, shalom. How many of you have heard this word, shalom? I want you to say that with me. Let's say it. Shalom. Just sounds cool, doesn't it? You can try that on your friends and your neighbors and impress them. You know, shalom is not a word that we hear every day. So it has a sort of ring to it. I love hearing words that I don't commonly hear. It's inspiring. It's intriguing. The other night I was sitting with my boys and our next door neighbors, and we were watching the fireworks out back. And where I live, there's this giant field, and from where we live, we can see like three different cities' fireworks displays from our backyard. So as a side note, if you're interested next year, for $10, you can come to our house and get all you can eat fireworks. Anyway, I was sitting with my neighbor and our boys, and we're up in the little stand on one of the swing sets. We're all up in there. We just have this amazing view, and I just felt overwhelmed with gratitude and goodness, and so I just leaned my drink over to him, and I said, cheers. And he looked at me, and he smiled, and he's originally from Mexico, and so he responded with this word, salud. You know the word? I hadn't heard it before. He taught me that. And I thought, man, that's really cool. It's so different than what I say. And he said, that means somewhat something like cheers. It's a greeting, saying health be to you. Salud. Shalom's one of those words. It's a beautiful word. It's poetic. And it has this sort of biblical idea of when things are really as God intended them to be. When things come together in harmony, it's where the peace of God reigns freely. Shalom is about when things move and flow in the order that God intended. And I believe that you and I can work toward shalom, peace and justice. We can work toward those things. We can work toward right order in our own lives and in the lives of others around us. And so this final question is this, number three, how can I contribute to the shalom in the world? So when I ask myself, how can I contribute to the shalom in the world? I'm asking, what are those tangible things that I can do to build bridges of peace and be courteous toward others and often the other? And going back to our story, this woman at the well, she came by herself. And most scholars believe that's really significant because most women went together when they went to get water from the well. And they think she did this at a different time of day than the other women did because she was a promiscuous person. She was ashamed of her sin. She was embarrassed. And so we see Jesus planting himself right down in the middle of all of this stuff because he knew he would run into the other. And he gets into this conversation with this woman, someone who is living in sin, someone that no conservative Jew would ever do. And he takes a personal interest in her. So they get into this conversation. And very simply, Jesus asks her for a drink. And as simple as that is, you know, she's bewildered. And she wonders, like, why is this Jewish man talking to me? You think I'm scum, you think I'm a roach. Why are you asking me for something? You know what? I think he did it to bring shalom. To let her know that he saw her as fully human, that her life was worth something. And then he acknowledged the pain in her life, and he ends up pointing out that she's had five husbands and was currently living with a man who wasn't her husband. And can you imagine if the story stopped there? I think a lot of us come to church with the sort of idea of I'm trying to earn something with God because I stink in these five ways. A lot of people come through the doors of church and they think of all the things that they did in their life that week that they're not proud of. And they feel ashamed and they feel embarrassed. And so many people are afraid to even walk through the doors of a church. And I even know for many people in our community, taking a step to actually attending here was one of the hardest things that they ever did because they were afraid. And the story could end there with Jesus pointing out her sin and making her feel shamed and her walking away. But he didn't do that, did he? No. Jesus basically looked at her and said, hey, you've been chasing love in all the wrong places because you don't believe in yourself. You don't understand this truth that you're made in God's image. And he looks at her and says, it's good. And I can imagine in this scene that this woman holds her head high for the first time in a long time. And what'd she do? She ran and told the rest of the village, there was this guy who knows everything about me, and yet he still loved me, and he still affirmed me, and he still believes in me, and still says that my life has meaning. That is the message of Christ. And I hope you hear that today, that despite your circumstances and despite what you've done and where you've been, that's exactly what Jesus is saying to us. And what we saw with the townspeople coming to Jesus is exactly what happens when we shift our proximity toward the other and we ask ourselves, how can we contribute to shalom building in the lives of other people? By simply asking their story and acknowledging dignity, people respond. And I recognize that when you hear me say the words shalom building, you might be intimidated by that. It's a little intimidating for me. But I'm not suggesting that we start some massive program. I don't think God's charge to us is to start some new revolution that's going to change the world upside down. I think what his call on us is to be bridge builders to one person at a time. And it usually starts with simple things, doesn't it? And maybe it's serving those who are in a different position than us. Maybe it's reaching out and listening to other people and their story. Maybe it's sitting with their neighbor, or maybe it's jumping on Facebook and putting an encouraging post for someone or responding, leaving a nice comment. Usually it's in the very, very simple things that make the most dramatic impact. Or maybe it's simply in finding simple ways to connect people one to another. Simple ways to acknowledge to our friends and to our neighbors and to those who are very different from us that they're created in God's image and that he loves them just as they are. And I can tell you, as one of the pastors here in this community, that this is something we as a community are committed to. We're committed to seeing every single person who comes here as someone who's made in the image of God. And because of that, we see that every single person has inherent worth. And listen to me. As a matter of fact, when you walk through the doors of this place, you can rest assured that you're surrounding yourself with a community of people who have this value of goodness and beauty. And they will extend one of our other values, which is grace, because from the moment you walk in, we believe that God has a plan for you and that you're made in his image. And so while you might come here today feeling like you have a mountain of baggage, I'll just tell you who doesn't. And when you walk in the doors here, you're simply starting with equity in the bank simply because we believe to the core that you're made in the image of God. And that regardless of the color of your skin or how much money you make or where you grew up or where you live or how many lies you told or whatever it might be, we're committed as a community to calling that truth out that you are made in the image of God. And according to him, it is very good. And all I'm asking you to do, Orchard, is to take that very simple courtesy that's been extended to you and pay it forward. To extend that same equity to your brothers and your sisters in your neighborhoods and in your city and around the world, even if they're way different than you are. Listen, just as it's powerful in the negative way when we forget that very truth that people are made in God's image, it's very powerful in a positive way when we remember. So what about you? Can you imagine a world where we're doing this in our relationships? Can you imagine a world where we consistently ask ourselves, who is my other, and breaking down the walls and moving ourselves, both our hearts and our bodies, in proximity toward other people and asking ourselves, how can we contribute to shalom in the world? Imagine a community filled with bridge builders and shalom bringers. Orchard, I believe we're that kind of community. And when you and I take a step toward what we've been given, that same courtesy that God gives us, and the same courtesy that we give to you when you walk through the doors of this place, when we take that and extend that to other people, shalom begins to break through in our homes and in our neighborhoods, in our cities, and around the world. Let's pray. God, I just want to say how grateful I am that regardless of where any of us are in our journey, that you sit down by us and you gaze into our eyes and you're uniquely interested in who we are. You're the model and the epitome of shalom bringing. We receive that and we thank you for that. And I speak to every single person here, God, who came in this door, who's hurting today, who has pain in their life, who feels unworthy for whatever reason. God, remind them that they are made in your image and that according to you, it is very good. Let us be a people that will constantly look to see where walls exist and to break those walls down, seek to understand and move ourselves and our hearts when we need to, so that we can be a big part of what you're doing in our world, being a big part of being shalom bringers. We just submit that to you today in the name of Jesus. Amen. Orchard, bring shalom this week. You guys are loved. Have a good week.